Accession number 4487, Reel 2.
Major General Goodfellow, Reel 2. What sort of priorities did you have in ordering equipment for the Iraq Army?
Well, first of all, I had to provide the equipment in installments at the speed at which I could get the troops trained. I remember well that the first order was for only 30 six-wheel lorries, 30 hundredweight lorries of those days, which were an up-to-date design in 1928 in England. The orders for those first vehicles and the spare parts for them went out in the autumn of 1928. And I didn't buy any more for some months until the Iraq Army equipped a unit of machine gun carrying vehicles, the machine guns being ordinary Vickers machine guns, which were clamped down on their tripods in the vehicle, and of course the crews to man the guns. They were invaluable because mobility was a thing which that army didn't really know about when it came to mechanical transport. They were essentially cavalry as the fast-moving arm, and of course behind the lines in those days, behind the army we had the camels and indeed donkey transport. However, by the time the first lot of men had been trained, we had a royal review, King Faisal I, I think one of the first army reviews that he had ever carried out. And I was just in time with these lorries to have one section of the lorries march past with the rest of the army in their correct place in their seniority, where the Royal Army Service Corps would expect to be, the last unit marching past. And I had rather drummed it in to one of the Arab NCOs that he must be careful using a lot of petrol on instruction work and so on, not to let his drivers have a lavish supply of petrol, because the bazaar was too inviting for anybody who might have been short of money. Well, when it came to the army review, the first section of lorries marched past, and just when they got in line with King Faisal on the saluting base, one of the lorries ceased to function. The others went on and left one poor lorry on its own. This was immensely embarrassing. But of course, the lorry had given out because the sergeant had curtailed the amount of petrol, which he allowed the driver to have anyway, and he learned his lesson that way.
Did you have anything to do yourself with the training of the men?
Yes, I did. It was quite clear that neither the officers nor the men had really any experience whatsoever of MT as we knew it. The men themselves, of course, had to be taught from scratch, but that was merely a question of teaching a driver. The officer, the senior officer of the two I was given, told me that I was perhaps fortunate to have him, because he had experience in transport in Istanbul, or what was then Constantinople, before World War I. And on asking a bit further, he admitted that the transport was the tram car in the city. But it was some 4 years after that that I found out that the tram cars in Constantinople, before World War I, were indeed driven by, or pulled by, two horses. So this was the sort of level at which one worked.
How quickly did they adapt to motorised transport?
Oh, they're very, as a nation, they're most adaptable. They're very quick at learning. It took some time for them to learn something accurately. But you see, many Iraqis were already started to be trained with the RAF out there. They were to become pilots. And I need hardly say that they were quick-witted people. It took some years to get their air force going, but before I left Iraq, I remember two or three of their pilots quite well. On the other hand, in my mechanical transport, we were ready in 1929. We were ready for the first of our active service experiences.
Before I ask you about the active service, I'd like to ask you the circumstances under which you were working. Whereabouts did you work in Baghdad?
Towards the north end, or the northeast end of the city, there was a large building which corresponded to our war office. It was known as the Iraq Army. It was their complete title. A very large square. One long side were the GHQ offices. One side was the ordnance offices plus the ordnance stores, with an open space because of the equipment side. One smaller area with the Royal Corps of Signals, who had one Britisher, rather in the same way as my MT had one. And then one complete side with its workshops and so on for me. And the whole of that cantonment, as it were, had enormous doorways. It took about four men to push open. It was well run. Of course, it was really hot, particularly in the middle of the year. The hours we worked were from fairly early in the morning, half past five or six in the morning, we were on parade, and you worked straight the way through till half past one or quarter to two. And then you went home, and you had your meal, and then everybody went to bed until tennis time at half past five.
What sort of recreations were there in Baghdad?
Oh, you, provided you did it at the right time, you could do almost anything. I mean, polo isn't a game that you would think of in the hot weather, but then polo was only played at half past six in the evening. Tennis was the most popular sport. Again, it was rather like Indo. You did it at the end of the afternoon. You got up and played tennis. We had wonderful shooting there, rough shooting. In the Iraq Army, of course, we had Friday with the Mohammedan day with no work, and Sunday, well, we went to work, but it wasn't all that necessary. And we used to go out, probably two or three officers with their wives, and we would spend the day taking an area where we thought we'd find something worth shooting. Black partridge was the favourite target. We did go shooting duck, but of course you obviously had to go to certain parts of the river to get the duck. And of course it meant travelling all night on a horse or some other method, or from a railhead, and to get to your shooting area. And then you've got the morning flight of duck. Sandgrouse galore all over Iraq. They were so thick when they took off the ground in front of you, would you really aim the gun more or less that direction, and with two barrels you brought down at least two sandgrouse. And of course you had beaters, because anywhere you went in the desert country, you would halt and you could count 10, and you would be surrounded by young Arab children who were there excitedly ready to turn up some sand grouse or partridge or whatever it might be. Then there were hares, of course, or hare rather, rabbits of a kind. Altogether we had snipe. From the name of all the birds we did shoot. In fact, we had one experience with a friend of mine without. We saw two immense birds. We chased after them a bit in a car so to get a bit nearer to them. And then he dismounted from his car and with a double-barreled gun shot two of these as they took off after they'd got to about 30 feet higher, 30 to 50 feet in flight. And these were greater bustard. Marvellous birds. Not all that good eating, because they've been eating fish to start with. So it was like some kind of, well, many kinds of bird eating fish. Of course, the flesh is somewhat fishy. But that was an experience. A great experience, in fact, all the things you could do. And of course, nothing cost money. As long as you had petrol to get out in your own car, we had our own cars. But you see, nothing else, your food cost very little, really.
What were you being paid at this time?
Hmm?
What were you being paid at this time?
My rate of pay as an Akid was 1,800 rupees, Indian money, 1,800 rupees a month, which is £1,800 a year, which in 1928 was extremely good pay, particularly when income tax was only 9 annas in the pound, which was practically nil. There was no doubt about it, we were all very well paid, because we were I was just a captain. I was a junior captain. It was always a joke that in the very hot weather, when things were very trying, and you sometimes felt like throwing a hand in, a great friend of mine always, at that stage he got to, he then removed his topi, and inside in the lining, he had written in large block capitals, 1,800 rupees a month. And having read it, he put his hat back again, which is a typical example of why it's worth going to a place where they pay you well.
You said you shared a bungalow. Did they provide this for you free?
Yes. Oh, yes, I never paid for anything like that. And they provide all the furniture of a set design. And a lot is rather like you would expect of the ordnance to do, their ordnance. Provided these chest of drawers and dining room tables and everything else you could think of. And we never paid. We handed it in when we left. I never remember having had any deductions made to pay for the very good furniture, too.
Did you have Iraqi servants?
Iraqi?
Servants.
Oh, servants. My bearer was an Indian. I had arranged, or I thought I had arranged, when I was in Hong Kong, I wrote a letter to my old bearer that I had had in India for a year and a half. And I always remember him living in a village called Chaldameldria in the Punch state near Kashmir. And I wrote in English. He couldn't read English, of course. But I wrote in English and I posted the letter in Hong Kong in an ordinary pillar box in the middle of the town, civilian pillar box in Hong Kong. And I said in this letter, if you can get down to Bombay by a certain date, you can come to Baghdad with me. And I shall be there 3 years minimum, and maybe more. Meet me at Joan Saab's bungalow. Well, I arrived in Bombay and there was no bearer, and I knew he had to come something like 1,200 to 1,400 miles to get down there. Well, anyway, I had to wait nearly a week for the ship to come. At the end of the week, he wasn't there, and Jones found me another bearer. A rather older man than mine, but a most excellent bearer. In fact, he went up to Baghdad with me, and after about 6 months in Baghdad, I was away going down the river, way about a week, and he, poor bearer, had been murdered and left in my bungalow. And everything else had been stolen, everything except the furniture. All our belongings had been removed. So that my original bearer had a bit of luck in not getting me in Bombay. I might add that my original bearer, who did the 1,200 miles, arrived in Bombay just after my ship left Bombay to go to Basra. So it was as near as that. It's all interesting.
You say that one bearer was murdered. Was there a lot of violence at this time in Iraq?
Well, no. See, we didn't have as many servants as one would have in India. Not quite so many. We had a bearer, and of course we had a cook. They were the main things. But we had a sweeper type of fellow. In this case, it was a Persian. And he was the fellow who had committed the crime in murdering my Indian bearer. And he escaped and was chased by a policeman all the way down to Basra. And the police were given a round sum of money so that they could follow him and, if necessary or if possible, bring him back under escort. Well, in this case, naturally the Persian fellow, the Iranian, I suppose we ought to talk about now, was going to cross over from Basra to Abadan and be free. And the policeman was just about ready to arrest him when the policeman ran short of money. And the only way for him to get money was to go all the way back to Baghdad to get some money to go down to Basra again. So naturally, the fellow got away with it, the criminal. It's interesting, that attitude. We didn't lead any life of danger ourselves. I think some funny things went on, Marco. I think there might have been a few criminals about the place, but it never affected us in any way.
Did you mix socially with the Iraqis?
Not really, no. I never went to the Iraqi officers' homes. I never went to the places where they lived. My wife used to call on the Prime Minister's wife. In this case, was Nuri Pasha, who was, of course, terribly well known, who was either the war minister or the prime minister alternately for a great number of years. A wonderful fellow who had won the Iron Cross when he was in the Turkish army in World War I. And when that war was over, he came to the... Before that war was over, he was brought into the British Army, and he won the DSO in our army, which is unique. A very capable man. In fact, one would say that he was responsible for the great advances made in forming a new army from scratch. He had a good vision, and he was a very brave officer. I had met his wife. He and his wife used to come to our British general we had in the mission, to his house. About the only Iraqi officer's wife that I can remember. In those days, after dinner, we always went in and played some form of rummy, was the way you spent your evening with these, usually about 10 or 12 people only. There was one case where my General Locke in the old days, in between two hands of rummy, he came around to the back of my chair and said, "Good fellow, you, if you wouldn't mind, go to the other side of the table over there, would you, and sit near Madam, whoever it might be." Then quietly in my ear, he said, "She's cheating." I'm not answering any names now, but even so, the story is quite an amusing one.
Was there a British club in Baghdad?
Oh, yes. We've lived there on occasions, particularly when my bearer was murdered. You know, we couldn't stay in the house. There was nothing in the house. And we had no clothes or anything to change into. So we went up and lived in the club. It's Al-Wir, which was a sort of suburb of Baghdad City. And, of course, that's where we played our tennis. It was very, 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 very good tennis things, courts. And they would have all the dances there. An ordinary club, rather like the clubs in India, only naturally not very big.
How many other people were there in the British military mission?
About 25 of us altogether. We had one British general. General Rowan Robinson took over from General Locke. He was had been a gunner, a retired gunner. Then the remainder of us, generally speaking, were captains. There were more senior ones, so the head G officer and the head Q officer naturally were, they were Indian Army, PSC, and their substantive rank was probably Lieutenant Colonel. Most of the British officers there had already become very fully qualified at their own job long before they ever went to Iraq. There were several gunner officers, absolutely first class at their job. Some names are extremely well known. As captains, there was Captain Charles Autry, who was a corps commander in the Second World War, and obviously knighted. And a more junior officer, gunner Bob Manser, who was then just a captain, who again became Sir Charles Manser, corps commander in our Second World War. We had, I was given after 2 years, I was given a British subaltern, just about being promoted to captain, as my assistant, because things by this time were getting bigger and bigger. And he also became a general in World War II. They had an Iraq Army military college and staff college, a small edition, of course, of British Army efforts in those directions. the British officers were absolutely first class. And all these people, of course, when active service came along, these officers went with the Iraqi troops. And although they weren't responsible and gave direct orders to the troops and the formation generally, what they said in the way of advice was obviously accepted. And they were an important part of the army.
What sort of impression did you get of their relations with the Iraqis?
Oh, very good. Very good indeed. All the British officers were very, very high standard of, at work and play. They were particularly charming towards the Iraqis. And that went a long way for the Iraqis to do as the British wanted them to do. It was better, of course, that way than having British officers who were commanding Iraqis and Iraqi troops. It was a friendly attitude, but shall I say the advice given was pretty firmly given. Otherwise, of course, the army wouldn't have worked properly. There would have got to be some disciplinary side of your life. The Iraqi army, they played polo, of course. They didn't play tennis. That wasn't their game. We had some cavalry there, British cavalry officers, two or three of them. And, of course, they were, just after World War I, they were an essential part of that army. They were stationed in several different places in Iraq. And, of course, they had, apart from active service, to which they were accustomed a good deal, they also had all the peacetime jobs, ceremonial work, and so on. And of course, they were very good. Some of the cavalry officers were from British cavalry and some from the Indian cavalry regiments.
How did you get on with the Iraqi officers with whom you worked?
Oh, very well, very well. I must say I enjoyed all that side of it very much. Occasionally they would come and ask for advice, but more often than not, of course, they would be there and you would give them the advice without them asking for it.
Would they do very much on their own initiative?
It depends what side of life you're talking about. They're very brave people, individually. They're brave individually. There wasn't the occasion for them to be brave en masse. And some of them, particularly the younger ones, showed considerable initiative in small things. And from that point of view, they were quite fearless about showing initiative. In fact, some of the things I wouldn't do myself that I saw them embark upon.
What sort of men were these, the officers in the Iraqi army at the time?
Well, some of them, of course, had been in the Turkish army because Mesopotamia, as it was under the Turkish Empire. And naturally, they were quite knowledgeable running their own units, and they had their own disciplinary outlook in life. I can only speak, of course, for my own MT units, but those that had been in the Turkish army were quite invaluable. And I really believe that with the infantry and gunners and so on, I'm sure their officers would say the same thing.
You mentioned earlier on about setting up workshops. How did you go about this?
Well, the building was easy because my friend Nobby Clark arranged the contracts to build the garages plus workshop. The machinery for the workshop I had brand new from England on a workshop lorry, which we had in the RASC of those days. And that was wonderful when it came to any operation, because you could move your workshop lorry and a stores lorry with your load carriers up to the north towards Kurdistan, say as far as Mosul, and there the vehicles would come into that workshop lorry for repair. So you didn't require anything in the way of heavy repairs in Baghdad. There was no point in having machines, lathes and drills and grinding machine, things like that on the ground. There was no point in that. Your machines that you could use, like a lathe and so on, were in the workshop lorry. And the drill, of course, and so on.
Who were the men who were chosen as mechanics?
The first lot I had were fellows who'd had experience in civil life. Or it may have been in the Turkish army, I really forget.